Hi, you guys. I'm Mara. I'm an alcoholic. And Johnny, I can understand where you're coming from. Monica can be persuasive. And I want to apologize in advance if you've heard my story before, because I was actually a really boring drunk. So I'm going to try and figure out like what the timing is so I don't regale you with stories of my drinking, which wasn't that interesting. Let me tell you this. I was born in Tampa, and my parents were married, and they were normal middle-class people. I unfortunately don't have like a great memoir basis to talk about with the two of them. That was kind of a lie. Okay, here's the thing. They seem normal. They're good looking, and they both have like normal vehicles and normal jobs. They're not like drug mules or bounty hunters or anything like that. But they they're like a teacher and a lawyer, and they got married when they were 20 and 21, and in the church and all of that kind of stuff. And 7 years later, they had me, and I was allegedly planned, so they were really happy. And they say, and the way that you can tell if something's true is if they're both straight on the story, because they've been divorced now since 1981. So they say they were happy to have me, and I was born at St. Joseph's Hospital, and I was brought back to Pinellas County, which is where I grew up. But just so you know that I, didn't go to high school with your sister or anything like that. I didn't go to high school there. We moved to Sarasota later on, but I'll fast forward through all that. So anyway, I grew up in a really, a really pretty nice neighborhood. It was, it was a development. It's not the kind of thing I would ever choose, but you know what I mean? Like that prefab crap. But anyway, it's one of those places that, people like to have, children, because they can ride their big wheels around and stuff like that. And so it was one of those kinds of places. And when I was growing up in the 80s, it was kind of a weird time, because Adam Walsh got abducted, and he would be probably like a couple years older than I am now. And my parents' generation, and they're all like baby boomers, like they acted like nothing like that sinister ever happened while they were growing up. And so they were really upset about it. So I kind of, there was all that like stranger danger type stuff going on. And when I was about, four and a half, our neighbors were really brutally murdered by my other neighbor. And my mom found the bodies. And my parents separated about a month after that. And there's a lot of, it was like a month before that. And then my dad came back, and then he got kicked out again. So the thing about that was that kind of was the beginning of my consciousness about the world and about evil in the world and uncertainty. And so I would say that the thing that marked my life the most was a feeling of kind of fear and insecurity and wanting to kind of attain a position where I wouldn't have to deal with unknown factors. And so I would say that was from fairly early on. My brother always says, among other things, that I was talking about how my college fund was, progressing when I was like 5 years old. And that's true. I've always been like a planner, because I'm afraid, I have like, I have disability insurance. I don't know why I think I might get disabled, but like ever since that Affleck duck came on and they're like, you might not be able to pay your rent if you get sick, I'm like, that's so true, So I mean, I'm like that. So a lot of people in AA are really big rebels, and I rebelled in some ways, but I really wasn't a rebel. And ever since I've been sober, I've really wished that I was, because I think that the best stories come from that. But that's not my story. Unfortunately, I'm just a run-of-the-mill drunk. I'm Irish, so I think that I'm genetically entitled to this disease. And if it wasn't, obvious enough just from that, I mean, almost everybody in my family is an alcoholic. My dad is an alcoholic. I'm not outing him, he would tell you himself. He thinks it's hilarious whenever they would say, like, that they have drink specials at Chili's or something. He'd be like, oh, I love a bargain, but I'm an alcoholic. So, because they seriously, dude, they give you two drinks there. So, all the time. And, you know, even though, you know, whatever, it's Chili's and somebody might see you there, you get two drinks. So you'll be drunk by the time somebody gets, you know, and whatever, they're there too, kind of like here. So anyway, I say a lot of crazy crap, and don't laugh at me because it makes it worse. I am really serious about this program and about my disease. I believe that this program saved my life. And if you drank like I drank, or worse than I drank, or did drugs like I drank, I think this program could probably work for you too. So I think that if you listen to my story and you don't relate to it because, you know, I'm too square, which I totally understand, stick around and listen until you hear somebody's story, because I will never forget the first time I was in a speaker meeting and I heard somebody talk about alcohol in exactly the same way that I felt about it. I mean, this guy was like, I was in love with alcohol. And when he was talking, I was thinking to myself, you know, I've always heard people say that alcohol was their best friend. And am I being recorded? I hope not. Screw that, dude. Alcohol is like the love of my life. Alcohol is like my ex-boyfriend. Seeing somebody drink my first few days of sobriety was like seeing the love of my life make out with somebody in front of me. I just wanted to punch somebody, you know? It wasn't my best friend, you know what I mean? Like, you don't get that passionate about your best friend if your best friend all of a sudden disappears from your life, you know? It doesn't make you suicidal to think about never seeing your best friend again, but, you know, your high school boyfriend, yes, you know? So that's the way I felt about alcohol, and my alcoholic father told me I was an alcoholic when I was about 7, and if you spend a lot of time with me, you'd know why. I have like a very addictive personality. I have like Nicorette in my mouth right now. I quit smoking like, I mean, I think a conservative number is 7 years ago, and yeah, and. You know, I mean, so, and I drink Diet Coke, I drink like 20 of them a day. You know, I once I get onto something, it's really hard for me to get off of it. And that didn't sound good. So it was like too many double entendres. So, okay, so here's the deal. I don't remember my first drink. Melanie, God. I have a sponsor. That's her. I don't remember my first drink. I remember the first time I got drunk with my best friend and her drunk mom, who's like a common phenomenon when I was growing up. Her wealthy lawyer father had left her mother for a much younger woman. Well, that had already happened to me and my family like, you know, 10 years before. So I felt like I had a lot of guidance to give, you know, like you're gonna have two Christmases and that's fantastic, you know. You're gonna get really cheap presents, and she's gonna look at you like you're a spoiled brat, and it's gonna be great. Don't think of losing a father; thinking of like gaining, you know, a secretary. So anyway, her mom would leave us at home alone, and she would give us booze, and I have no idea why, and I don't know why I started drinking. I had always said I wasn't going to drink, you know. I mean, I was going to grow up and go to Harvard and save the world and do all that kind of stuff, but by the time I was 15, I just felt so different than other people, and so I guess removed from mainstream society in so many ways. And I had, you know, had to take like tests and stuff like that when I was little. Like, you know, they do psychological testing to staff you into different programs. And it turned out that, you know, I was kind of smart. And what my mom told me at that time was, listen, you can't tell anybody about this. Because it's going to make people hate you, you know, and so just, you know, keep it under wraps. And so we moved to Sarasota, and Sarasota had like a special school, a special program, and I ended up going there. And that was like a big divisive thing in my family, because by that time I had two stepsisters, both of whom were high school cheerleaders at the big high school, and, you know, blonde and tan, and even though I'm from here, like, I can't get a tan, you know, because I'm Irish. And I didn't look like my new family. My mom, you know, married somebody who didn't look like he could be my father. Nobody would ever mistake him for my father. And I didn't look like the rest of them. And so I felt different from them. I felt different from them because I went to that school. And I started noticing that, you know, in the world, people who have a lot of money or people who are especially good looking just get away with so much crap, you know. And people who can, you know, throw balls really far. And so I was like, don't laugh at that. That was not supposed to be a joke. But the, so anyway, I was like, well, screw that. You know, I think that, you know, so I'm not supposed to be smart. Like, there's one good thing about me, and I'm not allowed to be honest about it. Like, I don't understand, you know. I mean, if I were 6 feet tall and had long blonde hair, like, people wouldn't tell me to cut it off, you know. So I'm not going to start using incorrect grammar because that, like, you know, makes you uncomfortable that I've read a book. So I turned into, kind of a bitch. And then I started drinking, which made it worse. But it made it better for me. I mean, as soon as I started drinking, the world kind of opened up to me, and I didn't feel awkward anymore, and I didn't feel like weird and I don't know, you know, clammy. Like, I feel clammy right now, and that's the way I always felt when I was growing up. Just like, oh my God, I'm going to start sweating. It's going to be terrible. I'm going to be shamed. I'm going to have to, you know, whatever. So drinking took that all away. It was like a magical potion. And as soon as I figured out that that was going on, well, also culturally, things were going on that were changing in the larger culture, and the mainstream started to not be the mainstream so much, and the subculture started moving towards the middle, and in the 90s when I was in high school, and many of you might be too young to remember like MTV before it had videos, but that was, I mean, you know, back when it had videos, there was like a whole reformatting, and like Kurt Loder was the person that gave me all my news, you know. I watched MTV News, and that was how I found out about like the Oklahoma City bombing and stuff like that. It was like, holy shit, Kurt Loder. So you know, it was before all that reality television, and what happened was, you know, Nirvana became really big, and the alternative music became really big. It was all on the radio and stuff like that. And actually, it sort of became kind of a joke that it was called alternative music. But what happened as a result of that was that I was no longer a dork. And so, yes, that was awesome, you know? It turns out that, you know, like, you know, back in the day, Ybor City didn't used to look like it does now, but La France was always there, and they always sold vintage clothing, and I used to love to come to Tampa and go buy vintage clothing, and that was, you know, that was before that became a really big thing for a lot of other people to do. And so the fact that we were wearing clothes that were too big for us and that were old and that, you know, smelled like dead people and stuff like that, like, they, you know, we became kind of cool. And what happened to me was I ended up, you know, dating the guy in high school that everybody wanted to go out with. And so I was cool, but I always felt like a weirdo on the inside, because let's face it, that's the truth of the matter, you know? I mean, I am quite strange. So anyway, I drank all through high school. I ended up going to school in New Orleans because that was the place that gave me the most money to go to school. And I never really was up to my potential academically, if you can really believe that, you know? I mean, I'm not sure why. And because all I cared about was, you know, being thin, which bitch was talking to my boyfriend, smoking cigarettes, and getting wasted. Those were the only things that I cared about at all. And, you know, anything, and I thought I had depth. I really did. I thought I had seen the world, and I wanted you to know that I had seen some shit. You know what I mean? Like, if I could, and I hadn't. I didn't know anything. I was very naive. So I moved to New Orleans, and that's where, you know, we really got into drinking. I met my best friend there, and the way that we met was like, you know, I mean, God, I think, put her in my life. And we just met on a park bench, and we both wanted to transfer to another school, and it turned out it was the same school that we both wanted to transfer to. And then, you know, we ended up getting high together and staying, so, because We couldn't move. Sorry, but we would stay inside her house and smoke pot during Mardi Gras and like just look down at the people, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I hung out with some people in college who were very close to me, and I had a wonderful time. And drinking for a long time for me was a really wonderful thing. I think that had I not found alcohol at that in my adolescence, I really don't know what would have become of me. I mean, I don't want to say that alcohol is poison and alcohol is bad and alcohol is bad for everybody. It's just that today I can't drink. I know it's going to kill me today. But back then, it enabled me to do things I otherwise wouldn't have done, like talk to people. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have talked to people. I was too nervous to go to the cafeteria and walk across with my tray because I thought everybody was looking at me. And that's literal. I lost 15 pounds my freshman year of college because of that. So, So. College was wonderful. I ended up going into a graduate program in Gainesville, which really sucked because in Gainesville, they close the bars at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they take your drink away from you at 1:45. But they'll serve you up until that point. That's right. I'm indignant still. So they, it was horrible. And by that time, I had already had my first blackout, but I thought it was funny. I really thought that stuff was hilarious at that time. I mean, you know, if you fell down or whatever, you know, lose your car, I mean, who cares? That's just, that was part of life, and I think we all kind of understood that, and, you know, I didn't really care. I mean, I remember my brother was like, didn't speak to me for a few weeks after I went on the bender after graduation from college because I, like, lost my shoes and my clothes and all this kind of stuff in his swimming pool. Because I went to a party and I wanted to go swimming, which was a big theme for me. I'd be at a party and I'd be like, you know what would make this party awesome is swimming. And there's and there's no water here, you know. And actually, there were times when we'd like sit in the bathtub. but you know, we were young and we were dumb and you know whatever. And you know, I was competent enough at my job that I had when I was in college and at school that I could drink that way and it didn't affect me as much as it started to later. And so I ended up going to law school. And in law school, I didn't drink. I knew I couldn't. And in retrospect, what I see from that is that normal people don't say, I'm not going to drink at all because if I drink, then I won't be able to make the grades. Or if I drink, then I'm going to embarrass my brother at his wedding. I didn't drink at my brother's wedding. Took some Xanax, but I didn't drink. And you know, I look really happy in all of the pictures, like really, really serene. And, normal people don't do that. And I was always doing that, you know. I mean, later on, I was engaged and they threw an engagement party for me. And I couldn't drink at my own engagement party because I know what I'm like when I'm drunk. Like, I'm out of freaking control, you know. If you disagree with me about political things, like, I might hit you. And I'm not, I mean, really, and the difference between me and maybe like a man that's been arrested a bunch of times is that I'm small enough that people would pick me up and take me away a lot. And so anyway, I when the police would be like, well, do you want to get arrested? I'd be like, no, you know, so the that happened a few times and they'd be like, we're going to arrest you for obstruction or whatever. And you're like, okay, you know. Call me when they, but anyway, so other people got arrested, but I didn't, and so I got lucky a lot, and I was able to keep drinking, and so we'd get wasted every year after our final exams in law school. In law school, you only take one exam, that's your entire grade, it's just one exam at the end of the class, and so it's really stressful. So you end up making, like, you know, 80-page outlines and staying in the library and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, this is in Gainesville, which is a football school. And so in 2001, after 9/11, they preempted the Tennessee game because they decided, you know, after all of the other conferences, that it would be bad to have a game right after 9/11. They made it in December, and so that was during exams, and there were all these drunks in ridiculous outfits, you know, like grown men in orange and blue, like jumpsuits and stuff like that, like guys that look like they could be your father, seriously. And they're wasted, and they're coming into the library to use the bathroom and stuff like that, and I'm so mad. But you know what? 2 days later, I didn't even know my own freaking name, you know? And I would always get, I'd always get wasted after the exams, and then I'd always cry for some reason. And I'd run into, you know, which is so obnoxious. I hate that girl normally, but I was that girl. So I would cry. Somebody would bring up my dead friend or something. And usually I think I would bring up my dead friend. You know, oh, my friend's dead. Feel sorry for me. So anyway, because it's, you know, you're really special when you know dead people. That's how you know you're special and that you have depth and that you've been someplace and seen something. So seriously, if I could have passed myself off as a Vietnam veteran, I probably would have. I mean, everything I said was true. It was just greatly, greatly exaggerated, which if you know any Irish people is just kind of like a cultural thing. We don't mean it. And I got my first job and I got engaged and all of that kind of crap went down and I bought a Volvo. I rented a house, I got a dog, you know, I got a professional looking haircut and I got drunk every night watching TV because my fiance would not allow me to have cable. And so I went and got an antenna and we got one channel, like barely, and it was Fox. So I would just sit around and drink beer and watch Fox every night. So I knew like the OC, like all of that kind of stuff, like by heart. But I hadn't seen, for years I didn't watch television other than Fox. So anyway, and Fox News, like it was really starting to slant me in a direction I was uncomfortable with. And so, not that this is about politics, but come on. So then, you know, I was engaged to this guy, and, you know, I really never loved him, and the reason that I was with him was that he had a really good job, and he liked the right kind of music, and he liked, you know, and other people thought that he was, like, a really good deal for me, and he liked me. And so, you know, he basically said, okay, well, we're together, and now we're, you know, we're going to get married, and you're going to move in with me, and, you know, whatever. Cook my dinner. And I was like, yeah, okay. You know, and on the face of things, you know, it looked like we were really progressive because I was like not going to change my name and stuff like that. And, you know, he was an atheist and I was an agnostic and we were like, you know, politically like moving forward and stuff like that. But really, I was like a housewife with a full-time job on top of it. And, you know, eventually it just didn't work out. I moved out to Colorado with him and I realized if I stayed there, like, I was so, so depressed, and I just had this feeling of, like, foreboding. I couldn't do it, and so I left, but he wouldn't let me take any of my stuff, so I came back to Florida with no stuff, and that's when I lived in an apartment with, like, no furniture, and I like, had a couple of outfits maybe to wear to work and, like, some other stuff, but I didn't have any, and that's when I realized, like, holy smokes, I don't make any money, because all the, you know, I thought that, you know, my income was good when it was a double income, but when it was just me living alone, I really didn't have any money, and I didn't have any furniture, and, you know, I had to avoid anybody that I had been friends with him, and so that's when I really started drinking a lot, and I decided what I was going to do is I was going to take this really difficult exam, mainly because he said that he didn't think that I could do it. And so every day I would work and every night I would come home and I'd study for this exam. And then I took the exam and I spent my entire life waiting for those exam results to come and I passed it. And when I passed it, I got a bottle of champagne and I sat there and I drank the entire bottle and I waited for my friends to come and pick me up. And we went out and I completely blacked out and I like fell down in the sprinklers and like scratched up my face and I had like bruises all over my body and like, you know, scabs and all this kind of stuff. And meanwhile, I have like a professional job that I'm supposed to go to the next day. So the, I felt so much shame and so much remorse and all of that because I really just couldn't remember what happened. And, you know, that was the first time that I was like, oh, I think I might be an alcoholic. And I meant it in a bad way. You know, I'd said it before, but I thought it was funny before. And so that was when I decided I was going to quit drinking for 30 days. And so I did quit drinking for 21 days. And then I decided that I was making a mountain out of a molehill, and I started drinking again. And for the rest of that, geez Louise, I don't know, year and a half or 2 years, I would drink like pretty much every weekend I would black out. And then during the week I would drink, and it was getting to be more and more, it wasn't an everyday thing, but it was getting to be an everyday thing. And when I would drink so much that I was always sick, always. And you know, I didn't have any like long-term health consequences that I know of. You know, I didn't get my liver checked or anything like that, but I'm pretty sure it's okay. And because I think I would figure it out by now, you know what I mean? I've seen a picture of a cirrhotic liver, and I'm pretty sure that's not what mine looks like. But I don't really know, you know. So the but yeah, I think I'm okay. I didn't have any long-term health consequences, but I drank for 15 years, and so what ended up happening was, you know, drinking, you know, feeling bad, sobering up, blah, 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 leaving work, going to take a nap, having my secretary call me in the middle of the day because my client's there, and remember not to shake his hand because he's been picking at his toenails in the freaking waiting room, which really was a phone call that I got once. I was like, all right, well, I got to go throw up, and I'll be right there. So the after, you know, and I used to do this thing where I'd go to McDonald's and I'd get like a massive Diet Coke and two plain biscuits, and the whole like trick of it was to try and get that shit home before I threw up. But I knew how to like hitch the door really quick and puke fast and close it and just drive away from the scene fast. So, I mean, I threw up outside the bushes at work. I mean, I could do like the puking tour of Tampa and Gainesville for you. And New Orleans, but those were happy times puking. Those were happy. Here I was crying. I was like, I should be married and have kids and be a freaking, you know, partner in a law firm, and I'm a loser, you know. I mean, it was terrible. It was terrible. And I was starting to look old. I'd look in the mirror and my face was just, I just didn't even recognize myself anymore. And most of my sins were sins of omission and not sins of commission. I wasn't stealing from people. What I was doing was just letting people down, you know. And the main person that I really let down a lot when I was drinking was my grandmother, because she was like in her 90s and lived alone over across the bay in Largo. And I was, you know, I would go and visit her, but I would say I was going to go visit her a lot and not, because I would be too sick to go. And so the day that I finally came into this program, I went to a party and all this seedy crap was happening, and it was very sordid. I was like, this is terrible. This is like some kind of a, I don't know, independent film where like everybody is ugly and yet, you know, too sexually amped up for their own good. I remember thinking that while I was wasted before I blacked out. So I was like, God, this is bad. And so the next day I went home, and because I never stayed at my house. Shit, no. And I remember going home and thank you. And looking at the note that I had left myself to go and visit my grandmother, because I knew I was gonna black out. And that was the wake up call for me. So what happened as a result of that was that I got sober. And I came into this program, and Guy King gave me a sponsor. I was talking about that last night in a meeting. You know, if you're new to this program and you don't have a sponsor, I recommend that you get one. You don't have to get the best sponsor in the world. You can always, you know, trade up later if you want, you know. But you have to, I mean, because I really thought that my sponsor should be like this motherly, you know, woman and all this kind of stuff. I ended up getting a sponsor who was like 2 years younger than I was and drank for a year before she quit. But she knew the steps and she knew how to take me through them. And that kept me sober my first year of sobriety. And the main factor in it too was willingness, was remembering what a nightmare it was for me on the inside. The outside didn't change, you know. I didn't end up getting a new car. I didn't get a new apartment. I didn't get a new job. But the inside changed, and it changed fairly quickly, because the first thing that happens is you start, you know, not feeling like crap all the time. And if that was the only thing that kept me in this program, that would be enough, I promise, because I felt so terrible before I came in. And most of the time, I'm in pretty good health now. But that's not the only reason that I've stayed in the program. I've met people in this program who have had hauntingly similar experiences in their adolescence to mine, and who feel similarly about things to me. And even people in this program that I don't even really like that much have things in common with me that are scary and would help me out if I really needed it, and vice versa. And so that all of that was wonderful. What happened was, I've stayed sober since June 24th of 2007, and I picked that date because I think that's the date that I was, like, totally sober. My first meeting, I think I was still drunk, and I was definitely sweating a lot, but, you know, that's a theme. And some of us just have, like, really overactive systems in some way, I don't know. I wasn't supposed to live here. Ireland is in the North Atlantic. This is a mistake, and I've been trying to get out my whole life, and I can't. It's like it just keeps bringing me back. So anyway, what happened was I ended up making kind of like a living amends to my grandmother, and I went to go see her every weekend, and we spent a lot of really good time together. And like everybody will tell you, I think after a little while, life happens, you know, and. You know, I was really lucky. My first year of sobriety, nothing happened. You know, I would go home and read my big book and tuck myself in and kiss my cat on the forehead and go to bed. I mean, seriously. Like, they told me not to date. I was like, okay, I won't. And not a problem. That is not a problem. So but what ended up happening was that my grandmother had what we thought was a stroke this summer. And that was right after I picked up my two-year chip. And so I went to go see her, and, like, I don't know if you've ever had a problem with somebody with hospitals and doctors and stuff like that. This is just to tell you that I really, all this time that I thought I was, like, a war-wounded veteran, like, I didn't know shit. And so I went, and they were like, you know, oh, it was a stroke. Oh, it was a brain tumor. Oh, blah, 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 blah. Well, she wanted to get out, and she had always been such a kind of feisty person that, you know, we decided it was best to spring her. And so we kept saying that. And I kept telling her, I was like, you have cancer, man. You can start smoking again. She's like, you know, I don't even want one. And she was hilarious. She was asking for a scotch when she was coming out of surgery. And when she died, she had 17 huge bottles of scotch in her garage. And, well, I'll get to that in a minute. So, so anyway, she got sick. My cousin came down from Baltimore to help out with her, allegedly to help out with her. And if I use the word allegedly to, I mean, I just use it all the time. I'm sorry. I never want to commit to something being the truth because I don't want to get caught on it later. But anyway, so she came down to help out, which is what she told us, which is why it's an allegedly. And my grandmother ended up breaking her hip and went to the hospital again because she, you know, the woman would just not sit down. And so my cousin was here. She was acting really strangely the whole time she was here. And she was supposed to be in this program. She had quit drinking. She'd struggled with alcoholism her entire life. And she was 40 at the time. And basically, she said that she'd quit drinking. She'd been to rehab like 6 months before. And so she was acting really strangely, and I thought she was going out on benders. And actually, I thought that it was drugs because I was like, well, you know, if you're drunk, like, drunks always think they can cover it up and stuff like that. Like, you know, if she's going someplace, she's going to, like, some kind of hotel or whatever. That's, like, a, you know, different deal. And also, I mean, in my family, like, unless you're me or my dad, like, you can't smell alcohol and determine who it's coming from. So, I can smell it, like, 5 miles away. But so she was missing. She was MIA for a while. She went and said she was going to go work out, and she was gone for like 8 hours. And then she came back. Yeah, right. I know. And she came back, and then everything seemed fine. And then I started getting all these weird phone calls from people who don't usually worry about people. Like, well, where's Monica? Where is she? Blah 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 blah. You know, my dad was like, I was in the house, and I think I saw her purse. And I thought my dad was, you know, I think my dad is just like, he's a man. I mean, how does he know it's her purse? It could have been her makeup bag, you know? He doesn't know. And so that's what I told him. I was like, well, you don't know, you know? I'll go check it out later or whatever. And he was like, and the front door was locked, and I had to break in through the back and all this kind of stuff because since he's one of us, he's very dramatic. And so anyway, I went to go see my grandmother in the hospital, and I went to go back to her house to go get her a hearing aid. And that house was like my house. I used to like clean that house and take care of it. And I told you I was there every weekend. And I went in the house, and it was really weird. It was a huge mess. And so I started cleaning it up, and I'm like cursing my cousin for leaving the house a mess. But it's strange in there. And I go in the bedroom, and it is her purse, and it is her phone. So then I start making phone calls on her phone, trying to find out if anybody knows where she is. And her friend's like, well, you know, we got to call the cops, blah, 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 blah. And I'm walking through the house, and I turned around, and she was hanging in my grandmother's bathroom. And she'd been there for a while. So the thing about that is that I think that this disease killed her. I don't think she could live with it anymore. When the autopsy results came back, you know, she had alcohol in her system. It was like a little like a scintilla, but who knows what the deal is with that. So I guess my message with that, other than that, is probably good for me to tell this, because for a really long time I couldn't talk about it in public, is that that killed her, and that was like looking in the mirror, because that's what I was going to do if I didn't come in here. And I think that I don't know why she didn't get it. I don't know why. My other cousin went up to Baltimore and met the people in her home group, and they all talked about how wonderful she was and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I don't get it. It's a mystery to me why some people get it and some people don't. But at the end of the day, you know, this thing kills people. You know, I mean, drugs will take you out really, really quickly, and alcohol will make you linger and linger and linger and linger until it eventually kills you. You can live with alcoholism for a really long time, but it'll make you really ugly. And if you don't believe me, it will. You guys are all young, but if you go someplace and you see old drunks, man, the first thing to go is your face. And before it does, it's like it goes down your body like this. So anyway, so that alone should be enough to keep you away from it. But it's also freaking depressing, you know? I mean, when it stops working, what do you do? You're at an impasse, you know? You can either get sober or not, but getting sober seems like the scariest thing in the world. And I imagine, you know, with my cousin and with a lot of people, it's really, really scary to get back on that horse once you've fallen off of it a few times. And the thing that I would say is I've seen a lot of people relapse. I've seen a lot of people come back in the program, and there always seems to be a lot of shame attached to it. But the fact of the matter is that if you relapse and you come back, everybody's going to be happy to see you, you know? There are so many times that I have wondered where people went, you know? I mean, people who seem to be really committed to the program and working the steps and here all the time and you know, doing service things and all that kind of stuff, and then they like, disappear. And you wonder where they went. And, you know, I pray for them, honestly, because I think if they have what I have, then at the very least it's going to make them miserable, you know. But at the most, it's going to kill them. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, my cousin's dead, but I have to live with that every day. What she did to the people in our family was, in my opinion, an act of violence to all of us. And it ultimately killed my grandmother, and who knows what the long-term effects of it are going to be. You don't know how much your life affects other people. There's no way of ever possibly knowing. And I think that my sobriety, whether people know about it or not, has affected a lot of people in positive ways. I think that I'm definitely less of a lunatic bitch than I was when I was drinking. My breath doesn't smell like puke, which is always a plus. And that's about it. So if you're and on top of that, although I wanted to drink, and I really did, I really wanted to drink when all this was going on. Well, I just wanted to check out. I wanted somebody to put me in a medically induced coma. But you know, the people in the program brought me back in, and I changed my meetings around because I was going to big meetings, and I started going to smaller meetings. But the people in this program listened to me talk about really nasty, ugly things. They they were with me every step of the way. And ultimately, I got through it. And things are going back to normal. It's a new normal, but it's a good life today. The thing that I don't have to worry about and the thing that's not in my life today is that I don't have any shame about what happened last summer. I was good to my grandmother before she died because I was sober. And I told my cousin that I loved her the last time that I saw her because I was sober. And I wouldn't have done that if I had been drunk. So that's all I have to say. And if anybody's new to this program, please, if you didn't hear what you needed to hear from me, stick around and keep listening to what other people have to say. Thank you.
My name is Brad. I'm an alcoholic. And this is Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all have the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you'll pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard the erring member, the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get to the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.